Good evening, everyone. On behalf of New York City Labor Against the War, I'd like to welcome you to our forum tonight, Attack on Civil Liberties and Immigrants' Rights. My name is Azalia Torres, and I am also a member of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys. This forum tonight is a first in a series of forums and activities that we are planning to address our opposition to an unjust war. Just as importantly, we want to address all the issues that arise from that unjust war, such as the attack on our civil liberties that we are doing tonight, as well as the U.S. response to bioterrorism, racist policies, etc. Our goal tonight is not only to listen to speakers. Our main goal tonight is to promote discussion, to promote an exchange of ideas to strengthen our responses to the challenges posed to every one of us by this war. More specifically, to strengthen labor's response to this unjust war. Now, to begin with, I'd just like to draw your attention to the statement that you saw, I'm sure, at the table, New York City Labor Against the War, our statement that we're asking folks who agree with it, of course, to sign on and join the many, many folks that have already done so. We have it at the table. We'll also be circulating it tonight. So please just take a moment and sign on to our petition and join us in our cry to stop this war. We want to begin by listening to four different speakers address aspects of the issue of civil liberties and immigrants' rights. Before I go on, I'm sorry. ¿Hay algunas personas que no entienden el inglés y necesitan intérprete? ¿Nadie necesita intérprete? Fine. I apologize. Okay, our first speaker tonight will be Nancy Chang, who is from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Nancy?
Thank you. Thank you. It's really an honor to be here. Remaining blissfully ignorant of world events and of the United States' role in those events is a luxury Americans could no longer afford, if they ever could afford it. In all times of crisis, and in particular in this time of crisis, there is a need for the free exchange of ideas, for dissent, for political protest, and this is all the more critical given the military and political decisions our country is making that are going to have permanent effects on this country, the world, its nations, and its denizens. Yet, this is precisely the time when we are told by Attorney General John Ashcroft that those who disagree with his tactics in investigating the attacks of September 11th are aiding our enemies. We are told by Ari Fleischer, the White House press secretary, these are times in which we have to watch what we say. We are witnessing the silencing of political dissent, and one of the things I'd like to do this with the bulk of my time is to talk about the USA Patriot Act that got enacted and signed into law on October 26th. It has a number... there are a number of provisions in this law that are not widely known, but that are going to affect all of us who are involved in political movements, and in particular, in movements with international ties. One of the provisions of this new law is Section 802, which creates a new federal crime of domestic terrorism. It broadly extends to all acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws if they appear to be intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, if they occur primarily in the United States. As you can see, this definition is couched in such vague and expansive terms that all of us run a risk of being charged with this if we are engaged in protest activities where spontaneous clashes take place between protesters and the police, we are all vulnerable to prosecution in such events because vigorous protest activities by their very nature can be construed as acts that are intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. I think that environmental activists, anti-globalization protesters, anti-abortion protesters, people opposed to the war, people who use direct action and civil disobedience to further their political agendas are all vulnerable to prosecution as domestic terrorists if events get out of control, and they are vulnerable to unwanted government surveillance. Another area of the USA Patriot Act that directly applies, or potentially directly applies, an ideological test is Section 411, and that prevents speakers from foreign countries from coming into the country if they are representatives of a group whose public endorsement of acts of terrorist activity the Secretary of State has determined undermines U.S. efforts to reduce or eliminate terrorist activities. These individuals can no longer come to the United States and give speeches, and as you can imagine, with such a subjective criteria, it's difficult to say in advance who is going to be considered such an individual. Though certainly there's the danger of discrimination on the basis of unpopular political viewpoints. The other part of the act that I'd like to spend a few minutes on is the part that strips immigrants of their constitutional protections. Section 411 of the law broadly defines the term terrorist activity in the case of immigrants far beyond its commonly recognized definition, which I think we would agree includes premeditated and politically motivated violence against civilian populations. Under Section 411, any crime that involves the use of a weapon or dangerous device other than for mere monetary gain could be classified as terrorist. This means that if an immigrant gets into a spontaneous brawl in a bar, picks up a makeshift weapon, and gets into a fight in it, there is a potential that this individual could be deemed a terrorist and subject to removal from this country. That's a risk that I don't think we want to expose our immigrants to in this country. And there's also a broad expansion of the term engage in terrorist activity. It now includes soliciting funds for, soliciting membership for, and providing material support to a terrorist organization. I know a number of immigrants have been providing humanitarian assistance to many groups in their home countries. They really have to stop and examine this activity carefully and raise questions about whether this might subject them to removal. To add to the problem of the term engaging in terrorist activity being so broadly defined to include things that we would consider protected by the First Amendment, at the other hand, the term terrorist activity has been broadly expanded. There has been, since 1996, a group of approximately 30 countries that have been, quote, designated foreign terrorist organizations. But under the new law, there's a procedure for the Department of State to designate even more countries as terrorists. These can be domestic as well as foreign. And an immigrant could be subject to removal for providing humanitarian support or other assistance to organizations that have never been designated. There's a third avenue which allows the Secretary of State to, the government to determine that a group is a terrorist group when two or more individuals, whether organized or not, engage in specified activities. When this happens, the individual has the burden of demonstrating that he or she did not know and reasonably could not have known that the act would further the organization's terrorist activity. So the exposure for immigrants who are politically active is tremendous under this new law, and this new law has to be studied carefully. I should mention just quickly that those immigrants who are considered to be terrorists by the Attorney General can be held for as long as 7 days without charge, and once they are charged on this very low standard that the Attorney General certifies that he has reasonable grounds to believe that the non-citizen is involved in terrorist activities, They can be held until their removal proceeding is completed. And there would be a review once every 6 months and the right of habeas appeal. But those are very difficult avenues to pursue, especially without a lawyer. And in all immigration matters, which are civil, there's no right to free counsel. So in short, I think that immigrants have to be careful in terms of their political activities. They have to consider the groups that they associate with. They have to consider whether or not the government might at some point conclude that these groups are involved in terrorist activity, and terrorist activity is quite broadly defined. And this is extremely unfortunate. And the irony of this is that immigrants who want to engage in peace efforts, for example, training organizations on how to present their international human rights claims to the United Nations or other bodies, or representing organizations in peace negotiations, or donating humanitarian aid to organizations, really have to think twice. One other topic I just wanted to go into briefly is that we have an outright war on immigrants, and this is taking the form of detentions. We have at least 1,200 people who have been placed in detention that we're aware of. Of course, the number is probably much higher. We've not been given a recent number, and very little information about them. We know that at least one person, Mohammed Rafiq Butts, passed away in late October in the Hudson County Correctional Center of a heart attack, it appears. He was a 55-year-old Pakistani restaurant worker, and he had given up his rights to stay in this country. He was seeking to be voluntarily departed from this country, and he was waiting to be cleared by the FBI, and he passed away in his prison cell. We've also heard stories of other immigrants who have been severely injured by other inmates, as well as by guards. So we've also heard that a number of these individuals have had trouble getting access to counsel, that they've gone for very long times without even knowing the charges against them. We're seeing a massive set of civil rights violations against immigrants. And the most recent news we've heard on this front, I suppose, might be the 5,000 or so voluntary interviews that the U.S. attorneys are going to be conducting in this country. In fact, in this month, they'd like to complete them in the month of December. I don't know if you've heard about these, but they've targeted young men from 18 to 33 who are from certain countries where the Al-Qaeda organization is known to have an influence, and who these are individuals who have a non-immigrant status. Many of them are students, some are tourists. And one of the criteria is that their entry be after January 1st of 2000. We were told that in New York City there are 86 such individuals and that the New York Police Department will be conducting home visits without announcements and asking them a series of questions that are quite personal and that delve quite deeply into political beliefs, and ask for phone numbers and names of family members and those with whom the individual is associated. It's not clear if the police department is going to be accompanied by any federal officials. The police department has announced the policy that they do not intend to inform the federal government of immigration violations, but if they are accompanied by federal officials, I'm not sure that we can count on that. A group of us have been just talking about how we can help these individuals. There's a group of attorneys who are willing to speak with people who are who believe they fit this criteria may be questioned. I just want to give out a phone number. It's a hotline at the New York Civil Liberties Union. It's 344-3005. That's area code 212. 344-3005. Extension 226 or 224 or 240. So if you know anyone that meets these standards, please have them call, and they should really speak to an attorney. And just before ending, I just want to mention that I have some copies of a pamphlet called The Silencing of Political Dissent that describes in some detail the USA Patriot Act, in far more detail than I've been able to go into tonight. So please come see me if you'd like a copy. I know this is available on our website, though it's a little harder to access there. It's www.ccr, that's for Center for Constitutional Rights, -ny.
www.7stories.org. It's also going to be available as an ebook through Seven Stories Press and available with Amazon. And the advantage of that version is that it'll have a forward from Howard Zinn, but also it'll have web links to the original sources so that you will be able to see the statute pulled up and you'll be able to see a number of the cases. Thank you very much.
Before introducing our next speaker, I have to apologize to all of you because I need to explain that we have with us today a group of high school students from the public high schools from the Educational Video Center. And they're doing a documentary on the events of September 11th. More specifically, they're focusing on the effects, the role of the media, and the roots of this attack. I think it's really commendable that our young folks are taking this on. Is a representative from the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, Kevin Fitzpatrick.
Hello, thank you for being here and thank you for having me. Well, you know, most cab drivers are from, by religion now, Muslim, and what do you think is happening? The night of September 11th, it started. Two cab drivers in the Bronx had the cab set on fire. These gentlemen were Bengali. That means they lost their living, basically. Later on that week in Bensonhurst, six guys had their cab smashed. The Brooklyn trick, smashed windows and slashed tires. Okay, they didn't have their cabs weren't total, but, that was about anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500 worth of damage. That came out of their pocket. That's the way the taxi industry is set up now. Now we know of two guys who have, just disappeared. Nobody seems to know where they are. This is the beginning. This is the beginning. Some people might ask why, obviously I'm not an immigrant. I'm a cab driver, but I'm not an immigrant. Why wasn't an immigrant driver coming? Well, I'll tell you, they're scared. Absolutely afraid to go up. On December 16th, we're having a big demonstration. We had a meeting, and we said we're going to go to the demonstration. And I made a suggestion, why don't we get our banner? We have this banner, New York Taxi Workers Alliance, and we can all meet under the banner and march under the banner. And I said, no. No way we're going to be marching under our own banner for this one. Because the way they see it, they're just setting themselves up for the FBI and the INS. This is the new reality. Most drivers are completely terrorized now. They're terrorized by the customers. I see people get into the cab and they lean over and look at the name on the hack license. Which they didn't do that before September 11th. Now I know if my name was Muhammad, a lot of these people would start screaming and get out of the cab. But we know this happens all the time now. This is really a great way to work. This is only one thing. We see this as maybe an isolated instance, but it's not. This is part and parcel of a plan. I think we all know about, at this point, you have to know about what's happened to Black and Hispanic youth. They've been criminalized by the system. How many Black and Hispanic kids are in jail now for, great crimes like possession of a joint or something along those lines? Or, minor fines. There's a reason why you criminalize a working class. You criminalize it to keep the wages down. What do you do with immigrant labor? How do you keep them down? Well, if you don't provide them with papers, they're by definition already half criminalized. And, people who don't have papers don't make $35 an hour. They don't have benefits. They don't have any rights at all. I see this in the taxi industry. The police arrest people. Cab drivers have disputes with the taxi bosses over how much money they owe. The taxi boss calls up the police, and the police arrest them for stealing the cab. I can tell you, we have a whole sheepload of stories like that. And this was before September 11th. What's happening now? You know, we know drivers now who, you know, the brokers and the taxi bosses, you know, take away their cabs after they pay it. And they say, well, he said, let's take them to court. Let's go hit them. And, well, I don't want any trouble. I don't want any trouble. You know, for somebody who comes here, you know, it's a terrible thing, you know, when people get arrested. We know, for example, people have been arrested and have been too embarrassed, too ashamed to tell us. You know, this is another way you control people. You know, salami tactics. Divide them up. Divide them up into little units. And, you know, we're supposed to be like little rats scurrying around, happy that we got our cheese for today and hoping that tomorrow, you know, we'll be able to keep our cheese. But they always seem to pounce. You know, they're not going to throw everybody out. But the thing, one of the things that's happened here is that you've been able to keep the wages down. People were getting, you know, immigrants were getting chesty. They were starting to think maybe we're entitled to some rights. But after September 11th, no. What are we, all terrorists, you know? Say something and you obviously support Osama bin Laden. Well, I mean, that actually might be an act of patriotism. Apparently, he's a CIA agent. But we know how these things are going to read. You know, it's not going to be that. It's going to be people who, everybody, you know, we have members in our organization who've been very active in politics in their own country. At this point, anybody, you know, who would oppose at all any aspect of American foreign policy is, as Ms. Chang was saying, is a terrorist or a supporter of terrorism. And, you know, people think that, you know, maybe some people think, well, it's only the immigrants. I don't have to worry. I tell you, I have a terrible feeling that by 2004, when Bush is going for re-election, there'll be American citizens who are going before these military tribunals. You know, if they can find that they can, you know, like, shoot and kill in 48 hours, man, why not do drug dealers? They're animals, aren't they? And that's the way it's going to go. You know, I think we should all remember, you know, the nation that enslaves another forges its own chains. We have a lot of things to worry about. Thank you.
Our next speaker is a member of the Arab American Anti-Defamation Committee, Abdeen Jabara.
Very gratifying to see such a turnout for this event this evening. Someone was asking me, how do we prevent the government from just rounding people up? And I, even though I'm a lawyer, I thought for a moment and I said, the way to do it is to build a mass movement. And this is what we're in the process of doing. We've been doing since the beginning of these attacks on civil liberties by the Bush administration, and we're going to continue to do it. On November 13th, President Bush signed an executive order allowing the creation of special military tribunals to try foreigners, including those in the United States, who are charged with terrorism. Conceivably, this could extend to the 20 million non-citizens currently residing in the United States. The justification for this by White House officials was that it was necessary to prevent a discovery in a public trial of government intelligence methods, which is absolutely astounding, given the fact that there have been at least five major terrorism trials here in the United States, here in New York City, which were able to be conducted, involving enormous amounts of evidence, involving enormous amounts of various U.S. intelligence methods, in which none of those intelligence methods were somehow compromised. In short, the government is trying to sell the American people a bill of goods in the process of trying to roll back the due process rights which are guaranteed under the Constitution. Another rationale that was given by the White House officials was that jurors would be endangered in passing judgment on terrorists. Well, we've also had in these terrorism trials jurors whose names are not revealed, some of whom are sequestered, who are given protection. Not one single juror has experienced any retribution or violence as a result of sitting in judgment on someone accused of terrorist actions. Now, the announcement by the Bush administration set off a flurry of criticism from both the right and the left. It was astounding to see people like William Safire coming out criticizing the idea of a military tribunal. Whereas some liberal academics, such as Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard University, supported them. Now, what is involved in these military tribunals? Well, number one, they're expected to be convened not here in the United States, but either on some ship in the ocean, outside of the jurisdiction of any courts, or on some territory controlled by the United States, but which is not part of the territorial United States, such as Guam. The military tribunals will be composed of military officers appointed by the Department of Defense, and they will be empowered to pass death sentences on a two-thirds vote of the military officers. The standard for conviction is not the standard used in criminal trials, a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's whatever the Attorney General says it will be. There's no appeal to a state or federal court. There's no right to a habeas corpus petition, which has been a time-honored device available to attorneys to challenge and to examine the method by which a person is being held. There's no right for the person to choose his or her own lawyer, and there's no right to confront the evidence. The rules of evidence that will be employed in these military tribunals are whatever John Ashcroft says they will be. Indeed, the rights that are obtained, if you want to call them that, in the military tribunals are far less than exist for court-martials. I don't know how many of you have ever served in the military. But in a court-martial, there has to be a unanimous decision by the judges, military judges. There is a reasonable doubt standard before someone can be convicted. And the rules of evidence are something that have been passed by Congress, considered by Congress, called the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, I want to say something about this military tribunal. This military tribunal is to come into being not by an act of Congress, not by deliberation by the elected representatives, not by advice and consent device, but rather by an executive order handed down by the Bush administration. Now, I want to talk about a moment about this executive order business, because ever since the passage of this Patriot Act that Nancy Chang has spoken about, which was a travesty by itself, because it was rammed through Congress without debate. There was no conference committee between the House and the Senate, no conference committee report, and it was, and we'll see in the long run the way in which this is represents an enormous attack on the rights of immigrants in this country. But since that time, the Bush administration has operated on the basis of the passage of executive orders. These are just fiats, if you will, by the administration, because they do not want to go to Congress and they do not want to chance it by having hearings and debate and what have you in Congress. Ashcroft said, for terrorists who commit war crimes against the United States, foreign terrorists who commit war crimes against the United States are not entitled and do not deserve the protection of the American Constitution. Well, how do you know that they're terrorists unless they've had an opportunity to examine the evidence, call forth witnesses, do all the things that we do in a criminal trial? Because if this is the standard that he wants to employ here, then anyone who commits a crime is a priori guilty of that crime. Now, these military tribunals were used during the American Revolution, the Mexican War, and the Civil War. But they do not have a place in our war on terrorism, because the standard, the every single case involving terrorism has resulted in a conviction for every single defendant. There's not, and given the climate in this country, it is very unlikely that even Johnny Cochran would be able to get these people acquittals. Now, there are two aspects to this military tribunals. There's a domestic aspect, and I want to announce here today that because of the criticism by members of Congress and the public and the media, we've won the first victory in this battle against the diminution of civil liberties. It's a small victory, but the first candidate for these military tribunals was to be a gentleman by the name of Zacharias Moussaoui, a French national of Moroccan origin, who's been in custody since August of 2001. First on immigration charges and then subsequently on a material witness affidavit by the FBI. Yesterday he was indicted. That means he will be tried in a regular criminal court with all of the rights accorded to a criminal defendant in the United States. And the papers have all indicated that the reason why they did not move ahead with him on the military tribunals is because of the public criticism. So we've got to keep it up. Now, there's another dimension that they intend to use this for. If they are able to take into custody people that they feel are high enough ranking members of the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda organizations, and those are foreign detainees, people who have come into custody of the Northern Alliance and the American forces in Afghanistan. We do not know how many of such people qualify, but only one name has come to light, and that is actually a client of mine, and that is the son of the blind cleric Omar Abdulrahman. It's been announced that he is in the custody of the Northern Alliance, And it's been speculated by the administration that his case would be a prime case that might be appear before the military tribunals. Vice President Dick Cheney said on ABC, in an ABC News interview on November the 30th, that he believed that Ahmed Abdulrahman, the son of Sheikh Abdulrahman, is in custody, and that interrogators were sorting out just who was being held. And unidentified White House officials were quoted as saying that this was just the type of case for whom the military tribunals were created. Now, whether or not they actually begin a tribunal involving him is yet to be seen. I want to move on to something else because of the limitation of time. And that is the matter of the surveillance and monitoring of attorney-client phone calls and interviews. That was also announced by the Justice Department, John Ashcroft. And I can tell you that as an attorney, I was absolutely horrified by this. I have a weekly phone call with a client in prison, and I'm absolutely terrified that that call is being monitored, and which would deny the rights under the Sixth Amendment for individuals to be defended and receive assistance by counsel of their choice. Now, the administration says, oh, we're sensitive to that. We're sensitive to that. Therefore, we're going to set up a system where the monitoring will not be done by a U.S. attorney or somebody from the FBI, but rather a specially appointed privileged team that will listen in and then come back and determine what of the conversation is privileged and what of it was not privileged. And that this team will be a, quote, firewall. They call it a firewall that will protect the rights of the attorney and of the defendant. Well, I can tell you that no attorney feels that this firewall will make him or her comfortable in discussing matters of the defense of his and or her client. Lastly, I want to talk about something else. How many of you have heard of COINTELPRO? Let me see a show of hands. I mean, I know the people who are certainly my age will have heard of it, but the COINTELPRO stands for Counterintelligence Programs, and it was a program conducted by the FBI from the mid-50s to the early 70s that targeted the American Indian Movement, Martin Luther King, the Black Panthers, the Black Liberation Movement, other aspects of it, Arab students in the United States, the New Left, individuals like Daruba Moore and Geronimo Pratt. And the language in the documents of the FBI that were received under the Freedom of Information Act uses these words to describe the purpose of the COINTELPRO: to disrupt and destabilize, to cripple, to destroy, or otherwise neutralize dissident, individual, and political groups in the United States. I fear that we are returning to a time in the history of this country where political dissent itself is going to be targeted. And the reason I say that is because 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, I was in Chicago at the time, and I picked up the New York Times, and I was amazed to see on the front of the New York Times on Saturday that the FBI had been instructed by the Justice Department, and the Justice Department was reviewing these guidelines that had been placed on the FBI about when they could initiate investigations. Now, after Watergate and after COINTELPRO, the FBI, which there is no statute that governs the FBI and how they can operate. There's absolutely no congressional oversight and control over what the FBI does. But the FBI was afraid that Congress was going to pass some legislation because of the incredible amount of bad publicity they got. And so they enacted internally guidelines. The last guidelines, I believe, were called the Levy guidelines, after Attorney General Levy. Before that, it was the Gray guidelines. But these guidelines say that the FBI cannot initiate an investigation unless there is a criminal predicate for it, i.e. that there's reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime is being planned or committed. That was the basis. Now, the Ashcroft Attorney Generalship wants to change that and wants to allow the FBI to go into religious institutions and collect information without a criminal predicate. I think that that is very dangerous. And you know what it's going to be? It's going to be mosques. All right? So I want to say here today that this gathering and other gatherings around this country have to not just come and hear the information, but we've got to walk away with a plan of action. We've got to walk away with some kind of an idea about what we can do in a unified manner to combat this, because otherwise it doesn't mean anything just to come and hear what I have to say. Thank you very much.
Final speaker is a member of DC 1707 AFSCME and a member of New York City Labor Against the War, Ray LaForest.
Thank you. First, let me do something I should have done at the beginning of this event. First, thank you for being here. You might not believe it, but I'm pleased to announce that there are actually three other events, just like this one taking place right now. One at Columbia University, the other one at the New School, and the third one, I believe, 190th Street. And I hope that they have as many people as we have. And if indeed they do, this is a good day. This is a day when we can sit down together and discuss issues that are vital to our future, the future of our society. I'm also very pleased because my niece is here, and it shows me that the new generation is involved with the struggle also. Hi. Before I start, I want to acknowledge that what we're looking at here, this event taking place in this room, and the concomitant involvement of this union to this struggle is very important. A union is a very complex organization with many weaknesses still, unfortunately, with a historical baggage that we're trying to unload. We've seen during the McCarthy years, union leaders can be targeted at given moments, isolated, and punished for their beliefs and activities. And so therefore, I'm grateful to see that this union, and Brenda Stokely. Brenda is the president of one of our most dynamic leaders of this union. And she can claim credit as much as anybody else for having having us where we are today. When I was asked to be part of this panel, I was thinking about talking about immigration, which is an area I'm familiar with, and the impact of these new changes on immigrants. And then I was told that Nancy would be talking about immigration. So I decided to, take a broader look at things, see what the hell is going on here, and what can we do about it. From the research that I started doing, I'm looking at some statement on immigration, and of course the so-called Patriot Act. We have to come back to it because it is a core, it is a document that crystallized, that justifies for them what they're trying to impose, the future they're trying to build for us. And I'm looking at things that are really incredible. I mean, it's building on the so-called 1996 immigration laws, which themselves were part of anti-terrorist laws, so-called, which denied individuals very basic rights that we take for granted in this society. And did that people very fought very hard to bring about and to maintain. I'm talking about, you know, the ability to send people back home, no matter how puny and the crime they accuse of. Pretty much treating them as though they were guilty until proven innocent. I'm looking at a section here, which, by the way, was prepared by the Coalition for Human Rights of Immigrants, that this Patriot Act expands the definition of terrorism to include any support for any organization involving any, in violent activity anywhere to influence government policy and public opinion. This means that someone who supported the African National Congress or any struggle in Latin America and other parts of the world where people struggle to control their own lives and better their future are forced to act. And those individuals indeed can be considered as terrorists. I see lastly maybe that this act allows indefinite detention in cases where the immigrant cannot be removed from the U.S. either because he has no country or his government will take him back. Now, are those things happening because we're dealing with very mean people? I suspect this is true. But it's more than that. Behind this madness is a very serious, determined, vicious logic, which is to create a new world order indeed. And we're seeing what they believe is the last nail on the coffin. This process that we're witnessing today did not start very recently. And indeed, I don't know if Bin Laden is responsible for this action, having been provided with proof. And I think we are entitled to that. I think the world is entitled to this proof. People are being killed in our name, innocent people. Because the climate that this has engendered, indeed is allowing them to bring about changes that they have been struggling to bring about for a long time. Indeed, this system at its worst has always relied on boogeymen. I remember growing up, you know, very young and reading about the Yellow Peril, those millions of Chinese, you know, that would somehow swim across the Atlantic and overwhelm our society when we were nuclear weapon, we were nuclear power and they were not. And indeed, what follows from this rationale is a subjugation of the political dialogue in our society. And the capturing of the dialogue, whereas their agenda dominates, and whereas rational thinking disappears completely. If we look at the history of development of nuclear weapons, this country has been solely responsible for the development of atomic weapons and its use against civilian population. Development of reentry vehicle, every single major step in the development of those weapons have been initiated by this government and paid for with our blood. And yet, the propaganda war that they have waged have managed to blame others for this. And this is what they're trying to do on a global scale. They're trying to wage that war using the boogeyman that they have created and wrap themselves in the flag and use our resources and everything that we stand for to bring the world to its knees and to bring it to there. What we saw with the very recently with the so-called Reagan Revolution, Gingrich, I quickly forget, was again exactly the first steps in this direction. A new world where the opposition, the organized left opposition no longer exists, where there's one power, and where there's the need for the transition for them to control power completely. There's a need to create other enemies, weaker enemies, to convince us, to convince the majority of Americans to go along with those decisions that completely go against the interests of the majority of these peoples, these countries' people, and indeed the world people. And I guess you could say they stumbled. They tried to go too fast. The American people was alert. They are enough progressive and working people who know the score, and there was a reaction. And somehow Newt was forced to go back into his hole, but the agenda was kept the same. The agenda is an assault on working people and the organizations. So as I said earlier, I don't know if Ben Laden is responsible for these actions. At this point, I almost don't care, because what I'm facing is much greater than Ben Laden and his organization. What we are all facing is a new world where our voices will be diminished, where we will have no say as to what our future should be and what our priorities ought to be. So that following September 11, 2001, we're living in a brand new world. I was in Philadelphia the other day, and maybe this is a sign of things to come, at a very peaceful demonstration for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And in the pretext of some minor assault by a youth on a woman, which might have been by a provocator anyway, the police descended upon us. And unfortunately, I don't have a picture with me here, but I have a picture of a policeman in a rage, a gun in his hand, his finger on the trigger, facing a completely defenseless crowd. And that was followed by the police riot, I guess you could call it, which resulted in 8 individuals being arrested, and with bail charges ranging from $8,000 to $80,000 for people demonstrating peacefully, being charged with conspiracy, attempt at rioting. So what we're looking at is a construction to intimidate us. The building of a structure, a systematic building of a structure that will create the laws, and that is what this Patriot Act is about, to create laws that will supposedly take care of our enemies and foreigners in our midst. And if you look at who are those foreigners, most of those foreigners are people whose societies have exploded because of exploitation of this very system and are forced to come here and toil and have been accepted in society because they could be exploited as a subject labor. But in this new world where we can have neoliberalism, we can have globalization and exploit them at home, we don't need them anymore. We don't have to pay them pensions. We don't have to pay them retirement. We don't have to pay welfare and healthcare for them. We can send them back home and pay them 20 cents an hour or whatever else we can get away with. So what I'm trying to say is that this is not an accident. Although individual actions or events could be accidental, we are living a drama that is central to the life of this society and that is directed in a very purposeful fashion. And make no mistake about it. And as we stand up and organize, we shall be roundly defeated and we'll be suffering the price for this defeat for many years to come. However, I'm moving ahead of myself. Your presence here is clearly an indication that you're not ready to abdicate. But anyway, we have time for more questions. But I do want to cover a few more ideas quickly. So the way I see it really, as a labor organizer and as a labor person, as a working person, a working class person, it behooves us to understand the nature of the struggle and the nature of the organization that we have to create to survive and win this battle. As working people who create the wealth and the resources of the society and ought to control them and own them completely. For years, they have controlled the educational system. They have fed us definition of racism, of patriotism that really pit us against each other and allow them to control the game. This war that is being waged by individuals who wrap themselves around the flag is being done at a tremendous financial cost and a tremendous cost in lives of innocent people, tremendous reparable loss. As working people, we have to worry about resources that are sorely needed here being squandered all over the place. And probably much scarier than that, they're setting up a system of redefining, of coming up with new definitions of concepts and actions so that patriotism means supporting what the president says, so that free speech means controlling yourself, so that they have the right to come in and investigate what you do and communications to the internet, and that they do it to consensus, because it is easier for them to do it to this consensus where we police ourselves within our own minds, and the force will be used only when necessary. Because when you use force arbitrarily, you always risk having a reaction, and they've been there, and they know the score. They have the force, they have the power. Let's make no mistake about it. But they will keep it at bay until they actually need it. And we have to avoid putting ourselves in a situation where these are indeed our choices. We see an intrusion in everyday life, and to me, unless we step up our activity and organizing, it's just the very beginning. For example, locally, I can tell you that this union is involved in negotiations, and we have been told by both the Giuliani administration and the one that's coming that there's no money, that they're $1 billion in the red. Actually, we have daycare teachers who have worked and have received a salary for the last 2 or 3 months. People who are union members, who have a contract with the city of New York, and I submit to you that this is that new reality, and that even though we have tested some of it earlier, we are about to face it on a scale unseen in this society unless we organize. Thank you very much.